I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Just a quick message to our audio listeners of the Manchester News Red podcast. One of our microphones malfunctioned during part two of the recording, so please accept our apologies for the slight white noise you may hear on Rich's mic throughout part two. We have fixed it as best we can, but just wanted to give you the heads up just so you didn't think there was something wrong with your headphones. Thank you.
Hello and welcome to the Manchester is Red podcast from the Manchester Evening News. I'm today's host, Rich Fay, joined by Tyrone Marshall. On today's show, we will look ahead to United's trip to face Luton in the Premier League this weekend. We'll look at the changes off the field for United. I suppose we'll have to talk about Kylian Mbappe as well at some point, won't we?
You definitely need to talk about Kylian Mbappe.
Ty, how are you doing?
I'm good, thank you, Rich. I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. We were joking before we came on there that it was good that Mbappe news dropped before, after Ten Hag's press conference, because he would have been asked about it. Should we just kill it straight away? Or, I mean, it's an interesting one, isn't it? Because United's stance used to always be, if there's a superstar available, we'll at least be in the market for them. We'll at least consider them as a player. Can you see Mbappe playing for United next season?
No. For a variety of reasons. I mean, I think everyone knows he's going to go to Real Madrid.
They said the same about Donny van de Beek.
They did, yes, famously. I think they're a little bit different in terms of stature. I can't see Kylian Mbappe ending up at Eintracht Frankfurt on loan in a few years.
And of course, Mbappe's not Dutch either, is he?
So he's not.
That rules him out straight away.
He's never played for Ajax.
No.
So, you know, he's no Rasmus Højlund.
He didn't have a loan spell at Vitesse either, did
no,
he?
So. No, I think Rasmus Højlund is the better, younger centre-forward. Now, I think everyone knows he's going to Real Madrid. I mean, the Premier League team that seems to be linked with him most often is Liverpool. I can't see that, never mind United.
Especially with Klopp leaving as well. Like, he's quite uncertain whether he...
Yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, yeah. I mean, Salah could go. It'd obviously be a very good replacement for Salah, but I don't see that happening. I think it's obviously always been his dream to play for Real Madrid. I mean, United's biggest issue is finance. They couldn't afford to sign any old striker on loan in the summer, in January, sorry. They signed Vuk Veghorst on loan 2 years ago. I don't think they could even afford to have done that this January. If they don't get in the Champions League, they won't be able to sign Kylian Mbappe's brother, never mind Kylian Mbappe. So I don't think they've got the money to pay those sort of wages that he's going to want, unfortunately.
Would be very United if they signed Ethan Mbappe and Jude Bellingham, wouldn't it, instead, and say, double announcement.
Got them in the end.
If we got them, get their shirts printed. I suppose there's another aspect, though, is that PSG have shown historic interest in signing Marcus Rashford. His future still is an interesting one, because I thought at Villa Park last weekend he did a lot well, but his end product was lacking again. It was timely, that he was the one substitute for Scott McTominay, who went on to win the game. Rashford is sort of third in the pecking order behind Højlund and Garnacho in those attacking power rankings as well. I'm still sceptical on what will happen with Rashford, because, Sir Jim Ratcliffe has said he wants to have homegrown players at United, and if you're selling an academy product straight away, it might be good for FFP. I'm just not sure that sets out the right sort of message. But, PSG will be looking to replace Mbappe. Do you think Rashford could leave this summer? Do you think PSG is the most likely destination if he did?
I think there's a decent chance of that. I mean, obviously, PSG have had interest in Rashford for a while. Obviously, there was his brother's meeting with PSG execs in 2022, which didn't go down very well at United, and with some in Rashford's camp, to be fair. At a time when his form had been terrible, I think he scored 5 goals the previous season, it was not a good look, and kind of sums up the PR missteps that are involved sometimes around Rashford. But, like I say, not brilliant at Villa last weekend, but I think he's improving at the moment. And like I say, he's the gold star, basically, of that academy at the moment.
He's
the poster boy of that academy. If they had to sell someone for FFP purposes, I still think it would be McTominay ahead of Rashford. I don't see...
Even maybe... Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it?
Yeah, I don't see a scenario where they're openly selling Rashford. I mean, PSG would have to make an incredible offer, I think, like maybe 100 million plus for United to even.
Even though he's had a poor season, it's not like it's going to be a fire sale. It's going to be 20 million for Rashford. You look, like you say, it'd probably be a club record sale of 100 million sort of area for him because what he brings. And you've got to remember as well, it is not what fans want to hear sometimes, but he's a very marketable asset as well, isn't he? It's not just the footballer that you get at your club. He'd be a top shirt seller, someone with a lot of social profile as well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's, you know, he's a big name footballer on and off the pitch for the things he did during the pandemic and taking on the government over free school meals and stuff like that. He is a big name on and off the pitch. I mean, it'd be a huge signing for someone like PSG. You can see why they'd go for it and the attraction of having an England international in that squad. But I don't think the challenge at PSG is anywhere near as enticing as United, especially for a United fan. I mean,
and you've also got to look from Rashford's point of view. It'd be, why would you want to leave United right now when it's finally looking like it's going to be exciting again?
Yeah,
you've stuck with them through the nitty gritty. Okay, that's part of the reason why you got your chance in the first place, because the sort of mismanagement of the club was why you were thrown in. But, you know, he would feel like he really had unfinished business at Old Trafford, wouldn't he, if he left as well?
Yeah, I think so. You know, he's been here so long now. I think he'll want to win things. He must feel like the club is on the up. He's, you know, last season was so good for him, scoring 30 goals, that he's kind of been allowed to struggle a bit this year. His place has never been under threat on the left at all, really. I mean, Garnacho is putting some pressure on him, but that sorted itself out now with Garnacho doing so well on the right. So, and like I say, I think his form has been improving in recent weeks. So, I can't see a scenario where United would consider selling him this summer, even if PSG did come calling.
Yeah, so next season, Mbappe's at Real Madrid, Rashford's playing for United. That's what we kind of expect. Movement off the pitch is what will be interesting United fans the most. Obviously, you did the line as well on Thursday that, you know, United are prepared to wait to appoint Dan Ashworth, and they are also interested in having Jason Wilcox as part of their new structure as well. I mean, what is the latest on that? Would you expect both of them to end up at Old Trafford from
here? Yeah, I think it's pretty likely. I mean, there's been no approach to Newcastle or Southampton yet.
This is, we're calling this Friday morning.
Calling this Friday morning.
As well, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, the Newcastle one is strange. I can't really work out why there hasn't been an approach, but it's obviously
especially if there's this gardening leave, surely you want to get it as soon as possible.
Yeah, well, I think the gardening leave is going to be dependent on what United pay.
Yeah.
I mean, Ashworth could hand in his notice and serve whatever gardening leave is in his contract, whether that's a year or whatever. Or United could pay 10 million and he could start in a month, maybe.
It's also, I find that a really compelling part of it, isn't it? Because you say 6 to 10 million maybe to get Ashworth. If that's a player, that's a bargain. And you look at the impact he could have at the club, that why would you not just pay as much as you can to get him in if he really is that much of a coup? Because, you know, you'd pay that on getting a squad player.
Yeah, I mean, you probably would. I mean, I can't recall any technical director being worth millions of pounds previously.
No.
And I think United also feel this idea of like a £10 million asking price is basically Newcastle trying to solve some of their own FFP issues. Yeah. I mean, we've talked about, you know, the Premier League's profit rules and how selling players whose fee has been amortised is great news. I mean, that works for the sporting director. Newcastle don't owe anything on Ashworth. If they banked £10 million, that's pure profit. That helps our issues. And I think United feel there's a sense that Newcastle are trying to play them a bit for that and damage United's own FFP issues.
And there's also the element of this summer, United want to enforce their new reputation as well. And if you're already being taken sort of by mugs by Newcastle and given into their demands, it kind of undermines everything you're trying to do anyway.
Exactly. I mean, they are prepared to wait. I can't see them waiting a year. Kind of pointless to wait a year. They are adamant they will wait a year, but just not going to happen. I mean, it's pointless waiting a year, really. So I think it will happen. Obviously, we know Berarda is starting in the summer. There's been no change to that. I would think Ashworth will start by the summer at the very latest, if not earlier. And I think Ineos see it as priority was chief executive done. Next priority, sporting director in process. They've clearly got the candidate. He wants the job. United want him. It's a matter of time, really, until Dan Ashworth done. And then it's building this team around Ashworth. And I think, although Berarda's on gardening leave, United have spoke to him enough in discussions around the job to know what he wants. I wouldn't be surprised if he's put Jason Wilcox's name forward, because they had a really good work relationship at City, apparently. So I wouldn't be surprised if Berarda has mentioned Wilcox maybe in discussions around the job, or if Ashworth has even mentioned him. And then it's building this team around Ashworth. So Wilcox is going to head up recruitment, by the sounds of things. then there'll be other people, I guess, in other areas. I think we might see more stories over the next few months about people that United are targeting. But it is, I've written a piece today. I mean, it's such a contrast to what the Glazers have done. You know, since 2013, the first 8 years, they just sat back and said to Sir Alex, yeah, you run the club.
Yeah.
And then after that, they've had to make decisions. They've appointed two chief executives, both internally, whose strength was in commercial. They appointed a football director internally, a technical director internally. You know, the most high-profile external job they've ever appointed is probably Dominic Jordan as head of data science or something like that, beyond a manager. And Ineos have been here for 8 weeks. They've poached a CEO from City. They're poaching a sporting director from Newcastle. They're bringing in someone well thought of at recruitment. He's at Southampton at the moment, but he did a good job at academy level at City. You know, they're showing more in 8 weeks than the Glazers have done in years,
that ambition
really.
As well. I mean, ambition. I suppose, not that they would be listening, but Man City fans would be saying, look, you're just trying to copy what we've done. It's far easier said than done. I know Pep said that after the Berardi coup as well, didn't he? He said, look, you know, it's not just him. You know, what did he say? Build him a statue if Berardi was the man who single-handedly sort of turns United around. And, you know, having these big players sort of boardroom level doesn't mean United start playing tiki-taka football and go win the treble next season, does it? There's a lot of work that still needs to be done, but United fans can only be positive right now, can't they? Because you've got to remember, even at the time of Ratcliffe's investment was first made public, lots of fans were sceptical of him because, look, he was working with the Glazers, not against the Glazers, and he had a lot of work to do to win them over, but, you know, I don't want to be doing his PR for him, but surely he must have most of the fan base on board now as well.
Yeah, I would think so. I mean, like you say, what he's shown in 8 weeks, really, they've been to Carrington probably more times than the Glazers ever have already, making these appointments, which is more than the Glazers have ever done. I think, you know, the contrast in ambition between the two is incredible, really. And I think they've definitely got to have won fans over. They're just being so proactive. And, you know, you mentioned City fans will be saying, you know, you're just nicking our best people, trying to be like us. I think United would agree with that, to be honest. Yeah. I think United are well aware that by taking Berardi, they are essentially buying some of City's intelligence. The same with Dan Ashworth, you know, some of Newcastle's intelligence, but more the intelligence that he's gathered from Brighton, who, you know, he's laid the foundations for a lot of what Brighton are doing now at the FA. Wilcox, the same with City, a lot of his background is City. United are well aware that, yeah, that is why we're chasing these people.
And that is kind of United's transfer policy as well, isn't it? It's like, United aren't in the position to take a gamble on a Championship player or to gamble on a lower Premier League player all the time. They want to buy these ready-made stars quite often because there's less likelihood that they'll fail. And, you know, obviously, they're not always going to go out and buy the biggest names, but by having that team who are there, proven and done it at multiple clubs, I don't see how it's a negative at all.
No, I think it's a definite positive. And like you say, I think City fans would look at United and go, you're just trying to be like us. And I think, like I say, I think United would go, yeah, we want some of that intelligence and some of what you've done. Yeah. And it is a case of just getting the best in class, which is what the Glazers have never done. Ed Woodward had never been a football chief executive. He was a banker.
Yeah.
Richard Arnold's success.
It was always thrown at the Glazers, wasn't it? Look, they just want the cheap option. What's the easiest hire? Whereas these are bold, ambitious moves.
Exactly. It was a finance. You know, Arnold and Woodward were both learning on the job as a football chief exec. John Murtagh is learning on the job as a football director. You know, he had a football executive background, but in less high profile roles. And then he's thrown in to be United's football director. And, you know, if he does leave, or if he's given a new role in it, I don't think there should be kind of a recasting of his time at the club. I think he's done a pretty decent job as football director, and he's pretty well respected within the game. But
yeah, I think
he's learning on the job.
And you've got to say his shortfalls are maybe just being in the wrong position for his skill set because he's been sort of thrown under the bus. I mean, he's not going to turn down that sort of role because why would you? Exactly. It's a great opportunity for him individually. Yeah. But it doesn't mean that that's the best suitable role for him, and there might be a better one elsewhere. Yeah, that's all for part one. Ty, before we go to part two, you've got are we going to get a documentary to plug?
Apparently we are. Yeah. I've never done a documentary before. Panorama, I think.
Yeah. How was it? You went to Broadhurst Park?
Broadhurst Park, yes, yeah. For FC United against Vinsky FC from Paris on Tuesday. Me and producer Seb went. I've been before and done it a couple of times. They play in this, some listeners may have read it in the paper last year. They play in this European tournament called the Fenix Trophy, which is basically a European competition for fan-owned clubs or like non-league amateur clubs or semi-pro clubs with kind of a
like a cultural importance.
Yeah, a social importance or a cultural significance.
Yeah.
So the team from Paris apparently are very, they've got 300,000 YouTube followers. They're like the Parisian hashtag United, wow, by all accounts.
What a glowing account that is. Maybe that's where Mbappe will end up. Who
possibly
knows?
So, yeah. Maybe that'll be his final move. The other team in that group is called the Krakow Dragoons. So FC United have already been to Krakow and played them. They're due to play them on a Monday night in Krakow, and there was a power cut after 20 minutes. They eventually got the power back on, just about to kick off, and the police turned up and said, there's a curfew, you've all got to go. So then they all went out on the lash, had to play their... FC United were flying back the Tuesday night, so they had to play the game at midday the next day.
Wow.
Played from the 20th minute before their flight. They all took bags to the stadium, 1-4-1 in the end. But that team is to help immigrants in Poland. Obviously, Poland has got, especially within football, it's quite far right. So that team's got 20 different nationalities. So it's clubs with like a cultural significance. FC United have been in it since the first year. They won it in year one, lost in the semis last year. But last year, the third and fourth place playoff in the final was at San Siro.
Yeah.
So FC United have played at the San Siro. Some of their fans were at the San Siro. It's a really interesting competition. So yeah, we went down on Tuesday to do a bit of a feature on it. And it's quite interesting. We were speaking to fans and the manager beforehand, and a couple of the staff there, and you know, the fans especially were like, this is the friendly European competition. We go for a drink with the fans afterwards. We all socialise. We all get on
very
together.
Anti-UEFA,
yeah, it is. It's a contrast to the Champions League. And they were all saying, like, don't get me wrong, I love watching the Champions League, but this is different. And the organiser said, like, if United play PSG, they shake hands and go their separate ways. Like, tonight, the players will all have a drink and a meal afterwards, and fans, if the Paris lot had bought any, would have a meal or drink and go out with each other afterwards. They're all talking about being the friendly European competition.
Yeah.
And then Avinsky just basically spent 90 minutes absolutely hammering, kicking, like punching FC United players. It was one of the like nastiest games I've watched in a long time. I mean, FC United battered them, clearly the better team, but went 1-0 down. And after that, I mean, some of the late tackles and like the digs in the ribs and stuff like that were incredible. Bit of it on the documentary. There was two players sent off I was going to call it a brawl, but it's basically a fight when FC United eventually equalised, trying to get the ball out the back of the net. We were stood near the coaching staff of Vinsky, and they just, I mean, they complained at every decision, despite the fact some of the tackles were horrendous. And yeah, FC United eventually won 4-1. But yeah, there's lots of sort of game footage there, but interviews with fans, and like I say, quite an interesting story. And FC United are still in Europe. Well, Manchester United aren't, of course.
Yes, you can catch that documentary. Is it next week it's out?
I think it's coming out next week.
Yeah, it'll be on our social channel. I'm sure we'll plug the podcast as well. So yeah, stick around for that. And like I said, stick around for part two, where we look ahead to United's trip to face Luton.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome back then to the Manchester is Red podcast for Manchester Evening News. I'm Rich Fay, joined by Tyrone Marshall. Luton then this weekend, a really interesting match. There was no questions of Luton really.
There
was one about how difficult Kenilworth Road would be, and Ten Hag in full time
kind of mode,
you know, saying it was the same referee, you know.
Yeah.
He played it down. I mean, he's played it in front of, I mean, you're not just been to Newport, do you know what I mean? Like, Kenilworth Road is going to be luxury to Rodney Parade. And you've got to remember, during his time in Dutch football, he will have played at a lot of low league grounds as well. But it's a compelling one because Luton, obviously they lost to Sheffield United recently, but they tend to be in most of their home games this season. They were only narrowly beaten by Arsenal right at the death. They've given a good account of themselves in the Premier League. I think they're not everyone's second favourite team, but lots of people have a soft spot for them and what they're doing on a modest budget and modest sort of club. It's got to be far easier said than done, isn't it, for United? Particularly United side, who have been so woeful at times this season.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, they drew with Liverpool there. They were leading against City. You know, they've had some good results there. And like I said, I think everyone admires the fight they've put up this season. I think everyone expected all three promoted teams to struggle, but we all thought Luton would be bottom. And, you know, they're not bottom. And they're in with a reasonable chance of staying up. And I think people admire what they've done. Rob Edwards, I think, has impressed everyone as manager. Ten Hag gives stuff like this short shrift. I mean, he was asked about Newport before that game and like, the, you know, the FA Cup, you go into this League Two team, and he was like, ah, oh, we have a cup competition in Holland.
Yeah.
And it's just like...
I am a manager.
I've played in a cup before. Yeah. Thanks. I was, as soon as I started doing it, I thought that might have been a mistake, but it seemed to come out all right. Yeah, yesterday it was like, is it 11 v 11? Is the pitch size different? Are we playing without a referee? So we'll see how his players cope with it. But it, you know, it is a bit different. It's clearly the type of stadium you're not used to in the Premier League. I can't imagine the dressing rooms are great. I can't imagine the press facilities are great. That's something the players won't have to deal with. But yeah, it's a test. It's, you know, Luton have made the most of their home advantage this year. That was probably always going to be a potential strength for them. And teams have found it difficult. They're an intense team, a high-energy team. Remind me a little bit of Burnley under Dyche, really, with the way they make it like quite a horrible experience. I feel like
you've got to buy into that, haven't you? That's your advantage.
You've got to buy into it, and your players have got to buy into it, and they clearly do. By all accounts, Rob Edwards is someone who really gets players on side, and you know his players really love playing for him. So I think they have bought into it, and it does feel a bit like, you know, Turf Moor is easy to win at now, but Turf Moor under Dyche was
fortress, wasn't it?
A bit of a fortress, and you just knew going there, you knew what you'd have to do to win, and you'd know that it wasn't going to be enjoyable, but you're just going to have to get through it. And there's probably a bit of that at Kenilworth Road now, which makes it a challenge for United, because I mean, their away form has improved, to be fair. The Wolves and Villa wins,
isn't it? Because obviously, the Villa win was the best away win they've ever had at Ten Hag, really. But you look at Wolves, they threw away 2-goal lead, you look at even Newport, they threw away 2-goal lead. In the end, they had that bit of class to get both games, but they could quite easily drop points, and you do sense that. I don't know if it'll be in Zidane, but you do sense if United win this weekend, it will be by a single goal, or maybe they get another one, like two. But like we said, we talk about how United turned a corner since that Villa game on Boxing Day, but as you pointed out, they lost to Forest after that. Are you buying into this theory and this belief that United have turned the corner, that they've got this momentum now, or do you still think they're only one game away from us all being doom and gloom again?
Yeah, I think they've improved. I think the attack is clicking a lot better. They're obviously scoring a lot more goals. I wouldn't say they've fully turned a corner. I think I said with Stephen on maybe on Monday that, you know, I still think they're too easy to play against. They just give up too many shots. You know, risk of reading off the stats again. I think it was 16 against Wolves, 16 against Tottenham. West Ham had 22 shots at Old Trafford. Villa had 23 at the weekend.
I remember a fun stat now, but it was United had by far, it was doing that as corner record basically. And it's like United actually had one of the best ratios of defending corners this season. It's just they conceded so many
of them
that
it
feels like they concede a lot, because they've conceded something like 160 170 corners this season, where Arsenal conceded 50. So it's
crazy, really. And like, I mean, the shots thing has been an issue all season. I've written about it before, the number of times the opposition have 18, 20, 22, 24 shots. I mean, that's just way too many for a team with ambitions of finishing in the top four. Like I said on Monday, that only one of their last 14 Premier League games have they kept the opposition below one XG, which is incredible, really. It means you're basically meant to concede every game. I think they will concede on Sunday, just because I think they give the opposition too many chances. The way they've improved, if anything, is they're scoring enough goals to win these games now, but I still think, you know, I said it on Monday, I stand by it, that if they're going to get top four or even top five, they have to improve. I don't think defensively is the right word. I think it's structural more than anything.
Well, that's the thing, isn't it? That United's results might have improved, but they are still playing quite similar to how they played at the start of the season.
Yeah.
Just they now have the goals to mask those defensive frailties, which they've not always been able to do. And it's, like I said, I just don't want to get too carried away yet, because, you know, it is, I think, one defeat away and it's all doom and gloom.
Yeah.
Of course, Forest away in the FA Cup coming up soon, blowing, you know, a big flash out of that in the treatment season. And you have to ask whether, you know, is top four Champions League qualification enough of a successful season, or are you turning into Arsenal in that regard?
Yeah.
I know there's enough change of pitch giving out more encouragement going forward, but that can't be the norm, really. Talking about the lineup then, Ten Hag said Luke Shaw's a doubt. Wan-Bissaka and Malacia still a few weeks away, so is Mason Mount. Luke Shaw was a precaution at Villa. Maybe a risk they don't want to take. So with the Manchester derby coming, because all that's such a big game for the top four. Yeah, what do you make of what United will do this weekend? Because they just you know, they just don't look right defensively, do they? There's not much they can do.
Not a lot they can do. I mean, it's obviously slightly more than a precaution, we're sure, the fact that he's a doubt a week later. And if it was a precaution, like say, you don't really want to risk him again with such big games coming up.
Even if it's a precaution, that Villa game was so blocking, you wouldn't have moved to take him off. Some players would say they played through it.
Yeah.
Winning that game is so important.
Yeah. There's obviously, I think, a concern that his injury record is, you know, not great, and maybe he's vulnerable to picking up.
There was a stat week that I saw, but it includes club and country. I didn't piece on it, but since he joined United, which is nearly 10 years ago now, he's only been available for exactly 50% of matches for club and country. The most he's ever had in a season for both is 78%.
Yeah.
It was last season, where, you know, I think he played 88% of games for United, but he missed 9 games for England, so knocked the percentage.
It was down,
For United, I think his highest ever season was 88%. Obviously, he had that horrendous double. Second season. But it's maybe the elephant in the room with Luke Shaw, but we always say when he's fit, world class, but when?
Yeah.
Not always a fly on anything. Maybe get the age that way. Do they need a proper editor to him again?
Yeah.
They've tried Malacia, but he's always seen them off.
That's it. I mean, Malacia's missed the entire season now. Obviously, had that the knee operation in the summer. Ten Hag confirmed yesterday he suffered a setback, which I think is why. I think they let Reguilon go because they thought Malacia was going to be back and has now had this setback. I mean, essentially, they've got one fit fullback this weekend in Dalot, haven't they? They've got to play probably Lindelof at left back, which might not be disastrous from a defensive point of view if you're expecting Luton to be quite direct. Having another big centre-half there might not be the worst thing in the world, but you know it affects their build-up. And I said on Monday's podcast, when they add those four right-footed defenders in the second half against Villa, they find it really difficult to keep the ball and build any attacks.
It
totally changed. When you're used to having Shaw and Martinez as left-footed options, suddenly you've got four right-footed options. I just don't think they can build the play as well.
There's an argument that Johnny Evans even... Have a gift,
hit. Maybe actually, yeah. Maybe having someone who can use their left foot, who is, you know, I think he's fairly two-footed, Evans, isn't he? I think he's, you know, he's very underrated in that regard. So I think you could probably play him at left back, maybe. Yeah. I wouldn't be against that idea. I still think he'll probably go with Lindelof, but I think Evans is a decent option.
Would you say maybe even play Dalot at left back and have someone else at right back instead? Or do you think that's a bit too much of a risk to play that position?
Yeah, I mean, Dalot has played left back, but I think he's clearly better at right back. I think, you know, there's an argument that you just keep a good right back in his strongest position and just go with a makeshift left back. I mean, Victor Lindelof, I think, played 3 games at left back earlier in the season when United were struggling and when Reguilon was injured. So he has done it already this season.
In terms of your preview then for the game, finally, I mean, what are you expecting? Are you looking forward to Kenilworth Road yourself? Yeah,
it's going to be interesting. I've been before. I've been and watched Shrewsbury when Luton and Shrewsbury were in the same league. It feels like a long time ago now. I've experienced it before.
You've experienced that so often posted about away end
through the houses.
Steal at away end.
Yeah, it is. Yes,
Sunday's got to be rotten with that. You'll see so many posts about this is the entrance to Luton's away end.
Yeah.
You've been there.
I've been there. I've experienced it. I remember it. Yes, I remember. We lost. I think I've only been once, but I might have been more often, can't remember. I've never been in the press area, so that's going to be interesting. I mean, it's going to be a different experience. Like we say, they've made the most of that home advantage, and I think it's going to be a really tough game for United.
Do you see them winning?
Yeah, I think maybe 2-1, something like that. Like I say, I think they'll concede, but they're scoring a lot of goals at the moment. I mean, Højlund can't stop scoring, so maybe that firepower and the fact that it's clicking for them going forward might just get them over the line.
I'll go for it. Maybe 3-1, actually. I can see United's meant to get another at the end.
Pull away.
Who knows what happens? We will be back next week on the Manchester Is Red podcast to look at what happened at Kenilworth Road and to look ahead to maybe more change off the pitch for United and the next fixtures on the horizon as well. Ty, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you, Rich. No problem.
And thank you very much, wherever you are in the world. A reminder, you can watch the video version of this podcast on YouTube. I believe it's also posted on our social media pages as well, Man United MEN. Please do leave a like and subscribe if you haven't already. And we'll see you again next time.